Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
All right, Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. Stone, how are you doing today?
I am doing well. Good morning, sir. I got to give you an update on my Dave Ramsey debt reduction program. I've got all the software up. I'm knocking out the debt. I'm going to be rich like in 22 years.
How many envelopes away from being wealthy are you?
See, you laugh at me about the envelopes, but that we got that from Dave Ramsey, and we have in the kitchen. We have this drawer with the envelopes, and we had cash in the envelope, so I grabbed a $20 bill, which is not enough for me to cover lunch, but I was able to buy my breakfast this morning.
So you took care of yourself.
I did take care of myself. So, no, I'm a big Dave fan now, so it's working out. I'm feeling
solid. We can ask our crew here what they think of Dave.
Yeah, we'll have to include that. So we have with us from the Georgia Society of CPAs an entire panel to talk about all kinds of interesting stuff, and we've got a guy kind of running the show, our trail boss this morning, I believe. So please join me in welcoming to the show Mr. Bill Harshman. How you been, man?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good to see you again.
It's good to be here.
We don't often get folks with ties in here, and we got like
it's a special treat.
We have our uniforms on.
You look great, but you know, you went with ties and suspenders, so I get the idea that you you're a risk management guy. You get all the bases covered.
I'm risk averse.
So, what's your take on Dave Ramsey?
I like Dave. I think he does a good job, and I think it's sadly needed in America today.
It would have been better if I had met Dave, you know, 20-something years ago, I don't think. So anyway, it's working for me, or at least it makes me feel like I'm exercising some control and taking some accountability for some less than financially sound decisions in my
past.
In my youth. Yeah.
Well, and you can always feel superior today because you're not as hair challenged.
That's a fact. And we're both radio hosts, right? Yeah. So there you go. So what's going on in the world of certified public accounting, man?
Well, I know it's not April, but we're still busy. Unfortunately, the government wants money all year long. And so our clients still seem to need a little help from time to time. And one of the things we wanted to talk about today was not-for-profit entities and enterprises, and really more from the perspective of the gal or the guy who is a board member of a not-for-profit organization. We have with us today Mark Azar and Carly Dooley. Mark, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, good morning. I'm Mark Azar. I'm a partner with a firm here in Atlanta called Smith & Howard. I head up our nonprofit tax practice, and I've been with the firm a little over 18 years now.
It'll be Azar, Smith, and Howard after the show.
Yeah, that's usually the way my fellow partners will agree.
But, when you get to 20 years, it's automatic,
it's all,
right?
Yes, just Azar and Azar.
And Carly.
Carly Dooley. I'm with Wyndham Brannan. I've been there 12 years, and I also head up the non-for-profit practice. So got a bunch of nonprofit experts here today.
Okay, well, why don't we start out by just telling everybody what does nonprofit really mean? I mean, I have some clients that are nonprofit, but they didn't mean to be. but there are companies or entities out there that intend not to make money. So can you give us sort of an idea of what kinds of enterprises we're talking about when we talk about nonprofits, Mark?
Well, sure. And there's a lot of different nonprofits in Atlanta is very rich with a ton of nonprofit entities. I mean, our typical charities is what we call a 501c3. Those are the, you know, your churches, your museums, your hospitals, your private schools, your universities. So those are, you know, the majority of nonprofits. But then we also have other types of entities that are nonprofit. You're probably hearing a little bit about this Tea Party, political type groups, these 501c4s, you know, they're really out there for social and welfare or purposes, but the issue is whether they're doing more lobbying and political than social. Then we get into our trade associations like the Georgia Society CPAs, they're a nonprofit, mm-hmm. Your other types of business leagues. And then another big area is your social type entities, your golf clubs, your fraternities and sororities. And so they're all considered nonprofits. And then mm-hmm. we can continue going on, but those are probably the majority of entities we see here.
So we're not just talking about charities.
That's correct. Okay. And they all have their own share of issues, but the idea is they're all run by a board and have a nonprofit motive.
Okay. So what we wanted to talk about today was sort of some of the board issues, and I guess in a generic sense what we talk about is governance. Carly, can you give us some idea of some of the mistakes or the problems that a typical not-for-profit board may run into?
Yes. Well, you know, most everybody, they're either child's in some kind of, you know, association, booster club. Everybody's been asked to sit on something or help with something. And people want to be a part of it, but they don't necessarily know what they're signing up for. And one of the biggest things that I see is that they don't really understand their fiduciary duties. When you sign up to be on a board, your duties, you know, you automatically are, you have potential liability if you don't have good faith, due care, and loyalty to that organization. So if you, you know, don't know what the rules are for nonprofits, if you're just sitting there to try to help, you might need to take more steps.
So let me ask you this real quick. If I've got the cheerleading money mm-hmm. from the last little mini camp that my kid's working right now, she's a high school cheerleader, I put it in my trunk and I lose it. I mean, that's badness, right?
There's not good controls there. No.
I don't think I'd want a lot of teenage girls after me.
But there's real responsibility and accountability associated with all this stuff that the average layperson like me, we don't realize. We're just trying to help and trying to make Kelly's, you know, junior and senior year something that she remembers.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I mean, and that's what you want to start doing. And in a lot of boards, when you sign up, there's usually people that have been on there for a while. So you just take what they say and say, oh, okay, that's how it's done. And, you know, there's a great wide world out on the internet. And if you, you know, just get on there and search for board responsibility, board governance, and you'll find a lot out there. A lot of people are intimidated to ask those tough questions as why do we do things? You don't want to rock the boat, you know? And I think boards today, with the public and the internet and the publicity that, you know, nonprofits and general are getting, I think it's smart to do your due diligence and to really get out there and look and see what you need to know.
You didn't have me pegged for a cheer mom, did you?
No.
See, I surprise people all the time.
What do you think is the first question that if you were being asked to join a board, you would ask before you agreed?
That's a good question. I would want to understand the savviness of the board and the sophistication. I mean, in regards to what we were talking about earlier, I think a lot of organizations get themselves into a lot of activities that they don't even realize what they're doing because they don't have a good business sense. They've got a lot of people that are mission-driven, but they don't understand the governance, the operations, the business side, and as well as the fiduciary risk serving as a board. Mm-hmm. And when Sarbanes-Oxley came down from the public sector down to the public charity sector, a lot of the stuff that we're going to be talking about policies, procedures, governance, now puts a lot higher fiduciary responsibility on board members. And mm-hmm. so you want to make sure before you sign up for a board that you truly understand sort of just the nuts and bolts about that organization, how things have been run over the past before you get them, you know, involved for the future.
Okay.
And sometimes that takes sitting on the board to really learn that. You know, you don't know the questions to ask until you get in there. So.
Well, there's I'll be honest, one of the things that I now ask and I didn't used to, but is does the board have D&O liability coverage? Mm-hmm. Not too long ago, I was asked to be on a board of a sailing club here in town. And we do have D&O coverage, but you think about it, every year this particular organization has somewhere between 80 and 100 kids, some as young as 5 and 6 years old, out on the water. They're teaching them how to sail. Now, they do a lot, and they're very, very safety conscious, but that doesn't mean an accident couldn't happen. Mm-hmm. And if you're on the board, you're going to hear from somebody if there's a problem.
Yeah,
and it could be a very, very you don't want to learn that you don't have insurance.
Yeah, that's definitely a good point.
Once you've had the problem.
You definitely want to ask about D&O coverage. And most mm-hmm. organizations, particularly the larger ones, will have it. It's the smaller ones that may right. not be thinking about it.
Yeah, it's the cheer camp.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you think about it, I mean, cheerleading is one of the more dangerous athletic activities for young people today in America. So, I mean, that could be an issue. So it's just something you need to be careful about. The IRS, I guess, since they sort of, I guess, have taken a role or stepped into a role in terms of trying to establish kind of basic ground rules for not-for-profit organizations in terms of what kinds of policies they should have. Carly, could you kind of go over some of the things that are now on the 990 that deal with policies that the IRS now asks, do you have?
Yep. They've got, you know, and the reason they do that is public disclosure. You know, these tax forms are out there for the public to look at and analyze, and a lot of people don't know that. But they specifically added questions regarding conflict of interest, whistleblower, document retention, board review of the tax return. And a lot of times, you know, you'll have one person that works with the accountant, they sign it and it goes and you never even look at it. And now they specifically ask, you know, did the board review it before you have signed and sent this thing? And meeting minutes. A lot of small organizations don't document meetings, and you might have an agenda, which is okay, but it's bare bones, but documenting your minutes is important to them, and at least they recommend them. Mm-hmm. They don't say that, you know, you're going to automatically be dinged for audit if you say you don't do these things, but by asking the question, they're encouraging organizations to have those policies.
How much of this kind of information is made available to the public?
Well, all of it's made available. It's the questions on the return, and some of them require written responses about how things are monitored and enforced. I mean, one of the things is not just to have a policy, but how you keep up with it. And I'm not a lawyer, don't play one on TV, but my understanding is it's actually worse to have a policy, say you're going to do something and you don't do it.
Right.
And so that puts you more at risk as a board member that you're not following up and keeping up with it. I mean, if I could sort of add to some of this conversation, when the 990 first came out back in 2008.
By the way, just to interrupt a minute, the 990, for those in our audience, is the number, because accountants always live by numbers, of the form that every not-for-profit organization has to file generally annually. There are some exceptions for very small organizations, but files with the IRS. And Lee asked the question, how much of this information gets out there in the public? And all of it, because basically once you file your 990, it is made available over the Internet by sometimes the government, but usually by other organizations who pick up and then republish this information so that anybody anywhere in the world, literally some guy in the Ukraine, can sit down and look at what that cheer camp has been doing lately.
Yeah, there's a website. It's called GuideStar, www.guidestar.org. And once you can be a member, it's free. And once you sign up, you can go look at any 990 to your heart's content for the last 3 years. Let me sort of back up. The 990's been around for years. That is the form that all nonprofits, except for churches, has to file on an annual basis to be in compliance, except for the very smallest organizations. And back in 2008, starting for the 2009 filing season, the IRS decided to revamp the return. It was the first time that the return was completely changed in almost 30 years. Decided the old return was outdated, the questions didn't make sense, just a lot of things didn't apply anymore. And a lot of these issues that the IRS was having about nonprofits, they decided to put it on the actual return and bring what we call a lot more compliance and transparency to the forefront of the return and made public. Because you don't really have an enforcer. We don't have an SEC overseeing public charities, and so a lot of people in Congress actually have been pushing the IRS to be more the enforcer, but they don't have the horsepower to do it. There's just not enough capacity, and so by making more transparent this information, looking through a glass ceiling, glass door versus, you know, a closed door, you've got a lot of organizations trying to be more accountable because this information is made to the public. Their donors, media, watchdog, charity type, that, you know, those charity groups that are out there looking to rate you to see whether you're worthy of a donation. But, excuse me, you know, when the IRS was coming out with some of this questions about governance, you know, we don't have those kind of questions for corporations or partnerships. You know, and the nonprofit sector said, where do you have the right, the IRS, to ask how we manage our day-to-day business? Where do you come, you know, with that ability to do it? And I think it was Schuler, I think, with the IRS. I don't know if you remember him. He basically said, He's one of the directors with the IRS and said, we believe we have a right to ask these kind of questions, and we believe you know, the IRS is definitely responsible for making sure that organizations are doing the right thing, safeguarding assets and in compliance. And we are going to continue to see more, not less. And actually, Lois Lerner, who is another director with the IRS, who happens to be on suspension, she was one of the people with the IRS that got put on probation. She pleaded the fifth with this Tea Party stories that you've been hearing about. She came out early in this year and said that they had done an analysis that they have come to the conclusion that organizations that are more highly governed are more likely to be in compliance in all different areas, not just with the 990, but everything that they're supposed to be doing outside of the 990. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they did this correlation, but they have come to that conclusion. And so I think it's the point here is that this is going to continue going forward.
Okay. We talked a bit about governance here, but there are operating issues, if you will, that in many cases, I don't think not-for-profits understand that they have to, in some areas, play by the same rules as for-profit businesses. Carly, could you talk a little bit about some of the, some of those operating requirements?
Definitely. Yeah, I think some of the things, especially the smaller organizations, ones that don't have staff people, ones that don't have, can't afford accounting firms and CPAs and tax people to do their payroll and do their tax forms. And one of them is 1099s. If you hire any or have any services that are over $600, you need to issue a 1099 form. It's a tax form that reports that that you have used services, vendors. And so you're required to get tax form filled out from that vendor with their tax ID number, which, there's a bunch of forms that go with it. But, these small organizations, they just hire somebody, here's the cash, and it goes on. And that's not technically correct. Same thing with, if you're a 501c3, which is, you can get a charitable deduction, a lot of these small nonprofits aren't giving receipts. And you, as a tax-exempt organization, are required to report the donations and give a receipt back to the person, and depending on materiality and the numbers. But it's stuff that the small organizations aren't necessarily, if they don't look up or know, things get passed from board to board, people roll off. And if there's not a good training program for the next person, which a lot of times there's not, it's just, okay, now you're in the position, take over. How are you going to know to do those things until you get caught or something happens and now you're paying penalties and things like that.
Now, how many nonprofits are there?
1.5 million, I think, which I think 300,000 are churches. So,
and of that 1.5 million, how many are those smaller ones that are going to have a tough time with this?
I'm not sure. I know that,
Is it the majority?
It is the majority.
So most nonprofits are just really small entities that are just maybe have a passion or a cause that they believe in, and they're just trying their best to make it work. And then there's a lot of regulation and governance that is required of them that might be a little over their head.
Well, I think these days the sector is growing exponentially. It's one of the biggest growing sectors, and where it used to be, internet groups or some kind of group growing, and nonprofit is just growing by leaps and bounds.
That every year they get 60,000 applications for new nonprofits. Last I looked, this is a $2.7 trillion sector, and as mentioned, there's about 1.7 total organizations currently. The IRS has actually been trying to clean up their roles. About a year or two ago, they had gotten permission from Congress, a couple years ago, but they started last year revoking small nonprofits if they hadn't heard from them in the last 3 years. And so they revoked almost 300,000 organizations that they didn't know existed. And we actually had a few that ended up on their roll by mistake. Mm-hmm. They had been filing 990s, IRS didn't have it in their system, or they thought we thought we were affiliated to a church and didn't need a file, but they didn't have that in their system. And so it actually caused even some organizations that shouldn't have been revoked to be on the list and had to go get reinstated.
Mm-hmm. And I think some of the problem is the IRS was sending out notices, but they were sending out notices to addresses that were long old.
Right. If you're so small. Hard to believe.
Yeah. Crazy.
How much of a headache is it to get a nonprofit started? And I asked for a very specific reason. Lee and I have had conversations. We both have a real passion for young people who are interested in business and particularly entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. And we've actually put some energy into thinking maybe we could set up this other entity that really caters to developing kids to have their own media platform. And I don't know, is it a real headache to set up a nonprofit?
I would say yes.
Especially if you already have a for-profit.
You know, it depends. I mean, again, political organizations, there's a difference. But with the regular form, it is a huge form. And you have to think through a lot of processes and get a lot of these policies in place to attach to that form. You have to do budgets for years out that you think. You have to do operating agreements, legal documents, stuff with the state, get all that done before you even file.
And the form is, Carly, the form basically is what you file with the IRS, and somebody in Cincinnati reviews it. Not necessarily Cincinnati, but somebody reviews it and determines basically whether or not your organization is entitled to charitable status and can collect contributions that are tax deductible to the donors. So that's the critical thing for most of these smaller, well, small and large organizations is, can I go out and solicit donations and tell my donors that they're going to get a tax deduction when they make that gift? So that's why this form is so critical to any new forming want to be charity organization. So,
and it's a long process too. Yeah. It's not a once you file it, they put it into buckets of, is this a cut and dry? Do we need to ask more questions? Does this need to be looked at? And it could take months, if not, I've seen many that came take over a year to get approved because they want additional information. So then they send a letter saying we want XYZ more. So then that goes in and that has to be looked at. And it's a lengthy process.
So when you're starting this, you can't have an entity. So you're starting with an idea or a concept, or you can have an entity that's just not a non-for-profit and you're trying to switch over to
You can switch. I mean, you do have to incorporate. The first step is obviously setting up a new entity and getting a name and a tax ID number and then asking for non-profit status. And part of what we're talking about, though, here is you have to have bylaws, articles of incorporation. You have to go get a board. You can't just have, the IRS doesn't like having a startup organization that only has two people on the board. It's just not big enough to truly be independent in your decision-making process. And so there's a lot of this information as well as how you're going to be funded and going forward to be sustainable to be an ongoing charity, as Bill was mentioning, to
but you're doing
status.
All this without – so they might say no, right? So you're going through all this effort, time, energy, and resources to create this entity that the IRS can say, no, that doesn't make the cut? Because you said $60,000 a year are trying for this status?
Yep.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So what